Argue the Toss from GameIndustry.com. I'm Shella.
And I'm Drew, and together we're arguing about the things that really matter in games and films and stuff.
Indeed we are, and this is Season 4, Episode 7.
Yeah, and it's films, well, it's kind of, it's a little bit cross-media today, because we've got one game, one film about a game, but we're actually looking at three films. Which we have seen recently, so this is kind of a film roundup episode. So we're going to be talking about A Wrinkle in Time, which we went to see on Saturday, was it?
Yep.
We're also going to be talking about Annihilation, which we both kind of saw separately because that's not getting a theatrical release over here. It went straight to Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tomb Raider, which we went to see, I think, was it the previous Saturday or sometime?
Yeah, something. Yeah, the week before that. Yeah.
Yeah. So quite diversely sort of genred films.
Yeah, definitely diverse in tone.
Yes.
And intended audience, perhaps even with A Wrinkle in Time.
Yes.
So we're going to start with A Wrinkle in Time. Mm-hmm. Which is the Ava DuVernay directed film, so making Ava DuVernay the first woman of colour to direct a film with a budget of over $100 million.
Yes, I read this.
Yeah, so which is kind of sad, which is great and sad at the same time. But there we go. But yeah. Then I suppose a white woman's only reached that milestone with Wonder Woman last year.
Fair enough, yeah, so that's a very sort of tarnished silver lining, really, isn't it?
Right, it is. Yeah. Yeah, sort of sad indictment of the film industry more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's based on, because as British people, we are not very familiar with A Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah.
From what I understand, it's a classic children's book, which is on lots of school syllabuses and things like this. But it's not over here. It's not something that's part of people's childhood over here.
No.
Watership Down might be or something. I don't know what the equivalent would be. Narnia, maybe.
Yeah. I'd certainly never heard of it until, like, not before the film. I knew of it before the film, but, like, only in the last couple of years through, like, mentions.
Yeah. See, I hadn't really heard. I think maybe it had been something, because it sounds like a familiar title.
Mm.
But, yeah, I didn't know anything about it or, yeah, that it was a children's book. So I think in America it's a much-loved children's book.
Mm-hmm.
And over here it's a pretty much fairly unknown children's book.
Yeah.
So we're coming to it from that perspective.
Yes.
So it is the story of a girl called Meg, whose parents are both scientists, physicists, and they discover a way to kind of wrinkle time and travel to different parts of the universe.
Although notably, there's no actual time travel involved. Like, it could be called A Wrinkle in Space just as easily.
So they discover this thing, and the father has been missing for, I don't know how long, actually. Is it 4 years? It's like the 4-year anniversary.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
No. Yes. It is specifically because the news picks it up for some reason.
It's like massive news that this scientist is still missing, and I suppose he's presumed dead. Well, actually, it's weird because some people presume that he's just run off with another woman.
Yeah.
So it's sort of shrouded in mystery, his disappearance, because I suppose people don't believe he's disappeared off to the other side of the universe.
Yeah.
They're thinking up more rational explanations for why he's disappeared. So Meg is, she's kind of got low self-esteem, because people are always gossiping about how her father left her and, you know, and what that implies for her relationship with her father and all these things. And she's also got this reputation as being a troublemaker, but for no real reason.
Yeah, we were talking about this after the film. Like, we're told that she's a troublemaker. She is called into the principal's office and said, oh, you can't use your father's disappearance as an excuse to act out all the time. But we haven't seen her act out at all. We've just seen her do one thing, which in context was perfectly valid and justified.
Yeah. So she's bullied by people, and she's kind of shy and, you know, sort of shy and clever, yeah. Sort of the sort of like nerdy, clever girl who doesn't fit in kind of thing.
Yeah.
And she has a little brother who's like a smart aleck.
Yeah, like sort of supernaturally smart in the beginning. And yeah. it's kind of implied that he is like, even more than that. It's weird because it is not sort of panned, that does not play out in the rest of the film, but at the beginning of the film it's like, oh, he might not even be her little brother, he might be some kind of, you know, magical,
he's
referred to as one of the greatest minds in the universe, so you think, oh, is he just like disguising himself as a child or something? And he's not, he's just kind of smart in ways that the plot does not go into.
So he seems to sort of have keyed into this magical world, so that when these kind of beings start appearing, these magical, so I don't know, like sort of goddesses or sort of spirits of the universe or whatever, sort of Gaia type figures in the form of Reese Witherspoon, Oprah Winfrey, and I'm not familiar with the other actress.
Mindy Kaling.
Okay. Yeah. So Reese Witherspoon, I think, is the first one to pop up, and he seems to know them all and be familiar with them. Which is kind of weird. Yeah, I mean, you kind of put it away to, because he's the youngest, that children are supposed to be able to be in touch with these sort of spirits or whatever, the spirit world or whatever. So I kind of put it down to that. Then they explain that they've heard a cry from her father across the other side of the universe, and that they couldn't go toward where the cry came from, so they followed its destination, and that's how they were led to Meg, and then they embark on a adventure to go and rescue her father. The other main character is Calvin.
Who's almost forgot him.
The cute guy. He's the cute guy at school who's in love with Meg, but he's like the popular kind of kid, you know, he's like the sort of standard popular kind of blue-eyed pretty high school kind of guy, isn't he? But he's in love with Meg, the outsider.
And again, I don't want to keep just jumping into like the plot recap with criticisms, but I want to point out that we are told that, we are not shown it in any way, that I don't think he ever interacts with anybody else on the screen apart from Meg and Charles Wallace. We don't see him at school being cool or anything. He's just kind of there.
Yeah, he just kind of, it is weird. It's kind of weird.
He's introduced into the story just out of nowhere as well. He kind of just turns up and then he's along for the ride. Which is fine, like, but it's odd.
Yeah. He literally says, I don't know why I'm here, I just felt like I needed to be here.
He does, yeah.
And there are just a lot of things like that where magic seems to make things happen for the convenience of the story, as opposed to thinking of an interesting way to make those things necessary for those characters. And I did go back and read the Wikipedia plot synopsis for the book, because not being familiar with the book, I didn't know how many of these narrative flaws were to do with the film, or to do with the fact that the film was trying to stay true to this much loved book, and, you know, that they felt they couldn't change because it would change it too much for all the people who are invested in their childhoods in this story. And yeah, it pretty much was the plot of the film.
It is. To be fair, in interviews I've read that with Ava DuVernay, they said that it had been previously considered unfilmable. Like, and I can imagine that there is a lot more in the book that couldn't translate to the screen. And I think the stuff that they have translated to the screen here is I mean, it kind of like I'm sure it's like one of the best possible adaptations you could do of whatever the source material is, but there were multiple points throughout the film where I thought, okay, this is clearly trying to depict a scene in the book that was described well, but doesn't really translate to actual visuals, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, what I said when we came out of the film is I have a feeling, not knowing this book, I have a feeling it's like America's Alice in Wonderland, which is a book that everybody, yes, including Tim Burton, fails to put onto screen. It just doesn't work because it's, you know, this sort of like hugely whimsical kind of just a story that you travel along through a book, and on a film you're expecting, you know, sort of we're schooled in three act structure when we're watching films. We expect, you know, sort of certain pace and things to happen for reasons, as opposed to just because it's whimsy and now there's a teapot and a disappearing cat. I had that feeling that they've picked a book that is probably really hard to make sense of on film, but maybe somehow carries you along in a book.
Because certainly with Alice in Wonderland, the whimsical stuff is there, but like the real meat of it is what it sort of paints like philosophically and mentally, and the strange sort of... in the case of Alice in Wonderland, it's more kind of mathematical and logical stuff. But it's about sort of reading along with it and then just having these weird ideas play in your brain that stick with you afterwards. Exactly. And in a film, you can't do that because as soon as you start doing that, you're dragged along to the next scene. It's not really the perfect medium for doing it. So you can see why Alice in Wonderland is difficult to film. And I imagine that there's a similar thing going on here. Because it did seem like a very philosophical film, but there wasn't much time to explore what that was.
No, exactly. Yeah. The main thing is it just seemed like a bunch of really pretty scenes that sort of, it's like, oh, so now we're like, oh, now Reese Witherspoon's like in a beautiful dress in our garden. Now we're traveling through the sort of wrinkle, and now we're on a planet and the planet's really beautiful, and now there are talking flowers and we're standing around going ooh and ah, and then it's like, oh, we're in a new scene that's really pretty and like has wow and stuff, and yeah, so it was just this bunch of scenes that, and some elements of it seemed really interesting. There was the scene like in this weird 50s suburbia, which was really menacing, with children just bouncing a ball in unison, and it's just like this really loud, rhythmic, kind of spooky sort of Stepford Wives feel to it. And I was waiting for things to happen, for some consequence of them walking in and obviously being outsiders in this world that is so structured and regimented, but actually nothing happened.
No, it was a really sort of strange and kind of disappointing closure to that scene, because it's sort of the classic kind of children's adventure thing is, you know, like the witch offers you an apple or whatever. They offer you food, they offer you comfort, and if you accept it, then you pay the price for it.
Yeah.
With that, they say the witch offers comfort, and they just kind of say no, and then she's like, "Oh, okay then. Well, take care."
Because she offers them food, and then Calvin's like, "Well, I am hungry," and she said cakes, and then and then they just walk onto a beach scene, which again is a really cool scene, and you know, this kind of dreamlike sort of frustration of not being able to get through the crowds and everything, and you know, being offered food, which is once again obviously sort of magical, and only some people are realizing it whilst other characters aren't, but it doesn't really come to that much again.
It's kind of weird after the previous scene, because it just kind of does the same thing again. There is this interesting guy who literally offers them some food, and this time they take the food, and I don't know why they've changed their minds after the previous scene, but even Charles Wallace, like the smartest kid in the universe, is like, okay, yeah, I'll eat this weird sandwich or whatever it is. He takes the first bite and it tastes like this isn't a spoiler or anything, it tastes like sand to him, and then he goes for another bite of another sandwich to see if that also tastes like sand, and it's just kind of, he's not actually as smart as the film has been telling us he is. It's just, yeah, kind of a weird scene.
But Meg doesn't eat the food.
Mm-hmm.
So she's obviously suspicious, which is also supposedly one of her flaws.
Yeah.
She sets up to have these flaws and be sort of reticent and, you know, always pulling him back and, you know, not trusting things. But she doesn't do anything about it. She doesn't knock the sandwich out of his hand.
No.
And then when he starts standing up and walking away with the stranger,
yeah,
her reactions are so slow that it's like, well, actually, she's not reticent and untrusting at all and suspicious of things, because she just lets him up and walk off.
Yeah.
And then suddenly is like, oh, we've got to run after him now that he's walked away.
Yeah.
So.
And sort of nothing different. She doesn't eat the food. Calvin does eat the food. And nothing different happens to either. Like, there's no difference in what happens to them. They both kind of go off after the... So that she's not rewarded for being suspicious. He is not punished for just eating the food. Mm-hmm. And when Charles Wallace is taken, it's not, like, directly because he ate the food or anything. It's something completely different. It's just a really thematically weird scene where you're not quite sure with it what they're trying to go for.
Yeah, exactly. And then... I suppose the ending is the sort of boss battle, I suppose you'd call it, because so the big evil in this is called it, which is changed from the book where it was called the black thing. So evil is black. I think Avis DuVernay was never going to go with that one.
Like,
so.
They give it the name of the planet instead, which I can't remember what it is. It's something like Kalamazoo or something.
It is something like that.
Yeah.
So in the book, I think it's just a brain in a room or something. So they had to kind of visualize it as this sort of like black sort of swirly cave place.
Yeah.
Which is fine. That's fair enough. But the way she defeats it is just by saying she loves her brother.
Yeah, it's the power of love. This is a children's book from the 1960s or whatever it was. It's kind of fine, but it just it does play as a bit cliched and old in this one. To be fair, I thought that scene was visually really interesting, because it's all like they're standing on like giant neurons and it, like, mm-hmm. they're inside a brain. You can see the electrical stuff firing back and forth. It's a bit like that Futurama episode where they do kind of the same thing in Fry's brain. And it's just like sort of very visually gorgeous, but not much substance to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something you could say of quite a lot of the scenes in this film.
It's a bit of a shame, because obviously had this sort of really ambitious project. But having said that, even though there was this kind of emptiness in the narrative, I was really moved by parts of the film. You know, the girl is biracial and her father is missing, and that really chimed with me. So sort of as a biracial child of an estranged father, it just it surprised me how I cried, basically. Like, I think it was like the very first scene with her and her dad just like brought me to tears. And I wasn't really ready for that, because I guess I'd never seen that. I'd never seen myself on film, like represented so much. I was really moved by it in places. And then also the bit where Calvin, the blue-eyed, white, all-American boy, says to the black girl that he likes her hair, was also just... I mean, that is just a monumental moment, because that is not something that society says to us about our hair. It tells us to use this product to remove frizz, because frizz is evil and ugly and everything that everybody, even white women, don't want frizz. So, so there were moments in that film, and I think it is an important film in those terms. And, you know, it's a shame that it's got a lot of weight on its shoulders.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it is a black woman directing a very diverse cast, and it's, you know, a black girl as a heroic lead, leading a white boy.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Ava DuVernay said that, you know, the key moment for her is when she says to him, "Do you trust me?"
Mm.
And then he says, "Yes, I trust you." And she says, you know, that is the linchpin of the film for her. So yeah, there's a lot of kind of heart behind what she was doing. And so yeah, it's a shame that it just didn't quite pull it off.
Like,
it seemed like a difficult project.
Yeah, like it's a great attempt at doing it, but I just don't think mm-hmm. in the end it works. And I think it probably, like, without having read the book, I am, you know, basically talking out my ass. Not talking about my ass. that's next week's podcast. But yeah, I can imagine that this works much better as a book, and yeah, is just kind of naturally not suited to be adapted to the screen.
So
it is a shame.
Good try.
Yeah,
it is, because I liked a lot of the things in it. Mm. Oprah was just perfect. Yeah,
she was
just wise. She is like this sort of Gaia kind of figure. Yeah. She's brilliant.
Like, those three are kind of my favorite characters in the film, I think. Yeah. They were certainly the most interesting. Mindy Kaling, particularly, I thought her character was great in that she only speaks through quoting other people.
Mm-hmm.
At least she does for like the first half of the film, and then there's later on it's contrived that she doesn't for a while, and then just happens. There's no real point to it. It just happens. Reese Witherspoon was very sort of, like, yeah, she was great as well. She was.
I really like Reese Witherspoon. Mm-hmm. She's just really watchable, I find.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and she was great as the sort of flighty kind of one, wasn't she? Sort of impatient with Meg and kind of.
They were all really kind of sort of like they seemed to be doing it very effortlessly. It was effortlessly funny. They were just a trio of really great characters who worked very well together.
It was really well cast, and they looked great, and they just seemed like they were having fun and slipped into those roles really easily. It was good. The only other thing is that Calvin is kind of surplus to requirements, and he even kind of gets forgotten in the end.
Yeah, he does.
Which is kind of, it's just a bit bizarre.
Again, maybe he had more of a role in the book or something that wasn't as relevant to the film, but...
Yeah,
it was just, he turns up out of nowhere, joins the plot, and he is just along for the ride for the whole way. And then once the plot is finished, he's no longer relevant to it.
He's not there for the battle, so they're not there. The three of it starts out with the three of them, but it ends with just Meg and Charles Wallace. And it's like, hey, what happened to Calvin? So did he go back already with the dad, or is he just like lost in the end? It's just like, and nobody cares.
So
that is A Wrinkle in Time. So tell us what you think, especially if you've read the book and you're familiar with it.
Do call us out on all the stuff that we've in the book it's this, and it's explained in that.
Exactly.
We'll definitely read that and care about it. I mean, you might.
So do let us know. We will read your comments and care about it. You know Drew, he's the grumpy one. What are we going to talk about next?
Well, I think since that's the one we've seen most recently, let's just start going backwards in time to, I think, the previous one we saw was Annihilation.
It was indeed.
Which is Alex Garland's new film. It got a limited theatrical release in the US, but over in the UK it came straight to Netflix. And there has been some... Alex Garland did an interview where he expressed some dissatisfaction with that because it was made for cinema. And while he understands that, you know, streaming services and TV are, you know, a legitimate new way of doing these kind of things, when you're making... when you're making a film, you make it for cinema, and it was designed to be seen in cinema, and streaming is not the ideal way to experience this film. And after watching it, like, I really enjoyed this film, sort of, to spoil my verdict on this. But yeah, I really would have liked to see this in the cinema rather than streaming through the internet.
Yeah, because it's beautiful.
Yeah, it really is. And it's beautiful in a way that the Netflix kind of streaming algorithm doesn't cover very well, because it's all very multicolored and
It's like an oil slick or the surface of a bubble.
Yeah, exactly. And Netflix video compression kind of doesn't do that very well.
Subtlety. Yeah. It would be nice to see it in the on the big screen for sure, because it's beautiful. And Alex Garland does frame his films really well.
Super.
It's one of the things I liked about Ex Machina.
Yeah.
It looked freaking gorgeous.
Yeah.
Like, shame about the
content. To be fair, I liked Ex Machina, but yeah, we've had that discussion before, I think. Didn't we do it? No, we did an episode on that, didn't we? We did the robots episode where we covered humans in Ex Machina.
Annihilation.
Annihilation.
Go, Drew.
It's kind of the premise of it is there is this thing called the Shimmer, which is kind of an expanding force field that has appeared on Earth, beginning at a certain lighthouse and expanding outwards into this kind of surrounding territory. And military teams have been sent into it and not come back. And now one person has come back. And are they married? I can't remember if it's explicitly stated whether they're just together or whether they're husband and wife.
I can't remember either. Okay. They're together.
Yeah, they're together. And she is a scientist as well. What is she? She's, like, in the books it's described, apparently the characters are described not by name but by their profession. So one of them is a biologist, one of them is a physicist, one of them is... And they're not given names in the book.
Isn't she a biologist?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, no, she is.
The other one is a physicist and an engineer, and they'd guessed that she was a biologist.
Yeah. So she is kind of, through various means, recruited onto a team of scientists who are going to enter the Shimmer, which is threatening to engulf the Earth, and investigate it, see what it's about, and I guess try and get rid of it, is kind of, or just to investigate it and see what they can do.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, how long's he been missing again?
I think it's
a year.
It's about a year. It's that sort of time, isn't
it? It's really interesting because these three films are with female leads who all have missing male characters.
Yeah, no, that is true.
Yeah, because I keep getting confused. I know one of them is 7 years, and that's Tomb Raider, and I was like, is this one 7 years, or is this a three-year one?
Yes, so it's 1, 4, and 7, so it's all three-year gaps, yeah.
And so did you say that he came back, Oscar Isaac?
Yes, he does. He comes back.
Spit up blood.
And he was very disjointed and didn't seem to know where he was, spit up blood, and then was abducted to this military facility called the Southern Reach. I think that's what it's called. It's something along those lines, where he is being investigated as one of the only person who's come back from the Shimmer, and she's there along with him, and she kind of signs up to be on the team that is next going into the Shimmer, which is a team of 5 female scientists, and the shot where they're about to go into the Shimmer, and they're all holding guns, and they all have backpacks on. And they look like the new Ghostbusters. It's a really sort of just instantly. That's what I took out of that.
It's also told in flashback.
It's pretty much
all flashback, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a framing device where she has returned from the Shimmer, and that's the framing device. They are talking to her and interviewing her about what happened in there. So it kind of it's not interested in, like, keeping any mystery to the plot. It spoils up front who lives and who dies.
Yeah.
Like, it lists them.
So it's like a sort of how done it.
Yes.
thing.
It's a spiritual sequel to Columbo, is what it is. which I think that's the only time you'll ever hear Annihilation described in that. But yeah.
Or if you want to elevate it, Crime and Punishment.
Yeah, okay. I haven't read Crime and Punishment. I have seen a lot of Columbo. So, yeah, and that's the kind of structure of the second two acts of the film, is that they go into the Shimmer and investigate what happened. And once they get in, it's, like, really interesting and strangely... not strangely filmed, but very interestingly filmed. It's all done in... At least at the beginning, you're kind of set in a forest, and you get the sense that the light isn't refracting right, or the spectrum is a kind of different colour.
It's so cool.
Yeah, and it's all done with this really interesting kind of shallow focus, so you can't quite see what's going on at the edges of the screen. And it does a really interesting job making something that's generally quite... Like, it's just a forest. It's pretty normal, but it makes it seem very alien and very otherworldly in very subtle and interesting ways.
Just like really magical.
Yeah,
it's like, I suppose in the true sense of fairy tale, it's magical and beautiful, but kind of eerie as well. Because it's kind of framed as this thing where people don't come back and he spit up blood. You're like, wow, this is beautiful, but it's beautiful like a Venus flytrap is beautiful. Yeah,
and it uses. Even early on, before you kind of find out what goes on in the Shimmer, it's using the language of, like, horror films and abduction films. Mm-hmm. The characters lose time. They don't quite know where they are. Their compasses don't work. So it's very mysterious, very kind of scary and worrying. Mm-hmm. And then they decide, even though they can't remember what's happened in the last 2 days, they've just arrived at a camp, which they have clearly set up. They decide, okay, well, the only thing we can do now is press on and just go deeper and deeper into the heart of this thing.
As
they do, the kind of scariness factor starts to... The dial starts to get turned up.
Although it's never quite goes as far as a horror film, does it? It's more of...
I think it wants to, at least. I think it is trying to present itself as something that is vaguely horrific. What I thought about it was that it kind of... tried to juggle a lot of different horror concepts and didn't quite focus on any of them enough to make it really scary. So it's part monster movie because there are multiple different monsters who attack, but there's also a lot of kind of Cronenbergian body horror in it.
I mean, for me, it was just visually, I think he'd borrowed a lot from The Last of Us.
Yeah, definitely.
It was, I mean, sort of abandoned swings and, you know, the sort of sense of abandonment and things, you know, the sort of the foliage that had grown back over houses and things like that when they're in sort of buildings and walking through empty streets and stuff like that. And even the fact that there are these sort of fungal growths everywhere. I was like, wow, that is The Last of Us. And I know that he does really... I think there's some article somewhere that I came across of him really loving that game. So,
The fungus stuff in particular is very, like, very evocative of the stuff you see, like, people that, like, against the walls in The Last of Us, like, just encased in spores and fungus.
In growth, but they even the fungus was beautiful, though, in the way that, like, a stalactite might be. You had sort of beautiful colours, like muted mustards and sort of purples and things like that. It was really interesting. It was just beautiful to look at. Mm. More beautiful than any horror film
I've
ever seen.
I think it does it better. It does this really sort of strange, beautiful... terrifying, beautiful, terrifying is a good, like, beautiful / terrifying is a good way of doing it. But, like, it's something that's, you know, kind of in all the best monster movies. There are elements of it in Alien. There are even elements of it in, like, The Thing, which I think some of this film took a lot from.
Both of those, for sure. Well, the original Thing, the original black and white one, influenced Alien, which, you know, sort of
influenced the John Carpenter version. Yeah, so, yeah, visually the film was absolutely sort of stunning from start to finish. It, like, I thought it did, there is a bit later on in the film where there is a CGI effect which I wasn't massively convinced by, and it's the silver...
The figure.
Yeah, the figure.
Yeah.
Which is quite strange and just looked a little bit fake and out of place. I thought that scene was still very good. I liked that monster. I thought... There was a lot of potential for that to be kind of silly and kind of... The problem with films like these and films like Event Horizon and the Cloverfield Paradox and Sphere, where something weird happens with the universe on a kind of fundamental level, is that they tend to degenerate towards the end into nonsense. Like, just things happen for the sake of happening, and it's just kind of waving your hands at the camera and going, ooh, isn't it weird? Isn't it spooky? And
yeah.
This film, I think, kind of does that as well throughout, but it's done with, like, such confidence and conviction that you don't really mind it. It takes you from one weird thing happening to the next weird thing happening, and it just kind of encloses that in one scene and then moves on to the next weird thing that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just... I don't know why that made it work for me, where other films, like, for example, The Cloverfield Paradox, which was also released on Netflix recently, and I watched that, and it's kind of...
I haven't watched that. I've heard bad things.
I didn't hate it as much as everyone else seemed to hate it, but it is definitely a flawed film.
Right.
And,
I might give it a watch then.
Yeah, it has that thing where just kind of a dimensional whatever happens, and then weird things start happening because of that, but there is no real reason or logic to them. And it doesn't hold together as well as Annihilation does.
Yeah, I think that's the thing Annihilation had, which I'm guessing just comes from the source material, because people wax lyrical about the source material, say it's really brilliant. So I'll have to give them a read. There's a writer friend of mine who said, he's like, I wish I could have written, you just read it and just kind of weep as a writer. Yeah, that it's like really interesting, just the writing itself. So, and it just had a really good reason why the things would happen. You know, I just liked the kind of the sci-fi behind the reasons, basically.
Yeah.
And that's why it hung together for me. It just worked.
Yeah.
And she was a cool character. Like, all the characters were really great, and
that's the other thing.
One was... where you were like, "Oh, I'm glad she's dead." Cause,
no,
yeah, they were all
like, even the one who's kind of set up to be not the villain, but you can see it, she's the one who's going to become a villain, like kind of right from the off. She is sympathetic, and you're kind of on board with her, even though she is unfriendly and she's not warm at all to the rest of the team.
So that's Annihilation. Liked it.
Really enjoyed
what
that, yeah.
What did you think? Yeah, I really liked it too. Although lots of people haven't, but there we go.
Yeah. Apparently a lot... No, apparently fans of the book did not like it because it takes quite a lot of liberties with what happens in the book and changes things up for... what they say is the worst. Not having read the book, I can't comment, and, you know, can only judge the film on its own merits. But it was, Alex Garland has said in interviews that they, even though he knew there were two more books coming out, he decided to just film the one, the first book as its own, and not planning to make any sequels.
Which is fair enough, and he wanted to make a good film. And
yes, exactly.
I think he did, and whether, you know, sticks. You know, it's like the decision that Garland and DuVernay had to make, isn't it, right?
They've
got these sort of much loved books, and they have to make a film that works, and
we can compare the two of them on that merit. I think Annihilation is much more successful an adaptation of a book I haven't read than A Wrinkle in Time is an adaptation of another book I haven't read.
Sounds like one is an easier book to adapt, to be fair.
Yeah.
So Tomb Raider.
Tomb Raider.
Which is an adaptation of a game we both played.
Yes.
So we're on good ground. We're on firm ground at last, dear listeners.
Tomb Raider was interesting.
It pretty much, for those I suppose we're going to assume that you are familiar with the Tomb Raider reboot, the latest reboot, which is young Lara on the island in Japan, and the film pretty much follows. Well, it takes its lead from that game in terms of the story and Himiko, the Japanese goddess, and that's the whole sort of like and the sort of missing father and following in his footsteps and all that thing and being stuck on the island type thing.
Yeah, it's a really, like, I would describe it as a very, very loose adaptation of the first game of the reboot. And I stress the word loose because it kind of just takes the main elements of it.
It
takes the setting and it takes
the goddess and the father story.
Yeah, but the rest of it is kind of changed up. She has a kind of different backstory in this one where she is, her father went missing 7 years ago after four in Wrinkle in Time and one, and she has kind of refused to sign the inheritance papers that would give her access to his fortune because she refuses to believe he's dead, which is not something that comes up in the game so much, where it's suggested that she's kind of just doing, she's kind of on her gap year and doing archaeology in the first game, as I recall. It's not specifically that, but that feels like what it is.
So for the film, they've obviously felt that she wasn't relatable to, like in my column, I wrote a column review of it for GameStreet.com, and I was like, you know, just make it her relatable to Generation Rent. They couldn't have just like this rich posh British person going around treasure hunting. No. So they've convoluted this way for her to deny her own inheritance.
Yeah.
Which is to not betray her father or whatever.
Yeah. So in the beginning we get sort of half an hour of kind of this setup where she's living in London, she's working as a bike courier rather than being, you know, the Lady and Croft.
She's living in Shoreditch, which is like you know, like hipster central of London, so like nobody who denied their inheritance would be able to afford to live in Shoreditch on a bike courier's wage. So it's still fantasy.
Absolutely. She is still like, she rejects the inheritance, but she still lives with a lot of its privilege, and that kind of comes through in like in the film throughout, and it's just a little bit sort of
silly.
It doesn't, silly doesn't quite work. But you know, so what is it like at the beginning of the, at the end of the sort of first act, she starts tracking down what her father was doing as when he disappeared, and she finds his secret kind of it's not a lab, it's a his secret office. Which,
yeah, it's like his sort of hideout.
Yeah, it's
his secret man cave.
Yeah, exactly. Which, for reasons which I'm sure aren't creepy at all, he's put in the mausoleum.
Because he wants to be Batman so bad.
And she finds all his research, and of course she decides to go after him and seek out what, you know, what he was seeking out, and follow him to the mysterious island, which he found and disappeared on.
So, and then he leaves the video saying, don't
don't
follow me, and for goodness sake, set fire to all of my research and this tape and everything, because otherwise bad people will know what I know and it'll be terrible. So she ignores that completely.
He's not very good at, he's not very convincing about it either. Like, even in the video he like promises like that it's gonna be really interesting what's in this box here. He said, oh, just don't look at it, whatever you do. Like, you don't want to know what's in the box underneath this tape. Just immediately chuck it into the fire. And I don't know why he'd leave that command to his daughter after he disappeared, but obviously she doesn't, and she starts she goes on her little globe-trotting adventure to find out.
And takes said documents to the bad people.
Yes, she does. Rather, you know, you could take photos of them, leave them in an encrypted thing on your phone, but no, she takes the diary or whatever it is, she takes all the documents and just lands on the island with them in her backpack. It's just
Yeah, it's a gift.
Yeah.
Gift to bad people. Mm-hmm. So the characters, I suppose the character from the game is Matthias. He was in the game as well.
Yeah.
He was the sort of like mad doctor, mm-hmm. Who'd kind of gone stir crazy from being alone on the island with his thoughts, which is kind of what they say about him, except the scene when he's saying, you know, I've been alone for so long.
Yeah.
There's all this chit chat and like ruckus outside because he's got these like Japanese slaves like chipping away at rocks and stuff. It's like, why don't you just learn Japanese or teach them English or something?
Yeah.
It was quite hilarious.
Yeah.
I've been alone for so long and there's all this like
just in the middle of one of the most populated regions that we've seen in the film.
Yeah, exactly. But so yeah, he just does lots of sweating and evil.
Yeah.
But not particularly evil, really. He's just sort of, a bespectacled sort of Indiana Jones type baddie,
And I think the second half of the film really is it's kind of an amalgamation of all of the Indiana Jones films in what it's kind of directly doing. And I that is sort of the origin of Tomb Raider anyway. So, you know, you can't blame it for going to that well, but it goes to that well a lot, that well of souls a lot. Indiana Jones reference for you there. there is actually a thing in the there is a chasm of souls in the film as well. So yeah, I'm not the first one to make that reference. Anyway,
it does. It goes there a lot, considering the game had its own thing which it could have lifted.
Yes,
it was just bizarre that it just went to Indiana Jones when the game had perfectly good scenes they could have used.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there was this sort of like beautiful Japanese temple that was set on fire and like there's loads of cool stuff in that game.
But instead you've got the sort of race of slaves, which is Temple of Doom. Then you've got them, they're the kind of last crusade like gauntlet
thing.
Of traps that they enter to get to the... And sort of the estranged father thing is another thing that Last Crusade does, although granted in a slightly different context. Although not really, like she still kind of has her Grail diary, doesn't she? She has the book that she's following.
Interrupt because I'm being distracted. My neighbour is setting out, I guess they might be fiberglass flamingos in
the
garden. Sorry to interrupt, but I just thought that was amazing. Anyway, back to Lara Croft.
So what was like kind of disappointing was that the parts where it is sort of directly doing Indiana Jones, they're kind of the most interesting parts of the film, because you've got all of this origin story stuff, which is the first act, and all I was thinking about through that was the game does this in one cutscene, one or two cutscenes. It establishes her character, it establishes why she's here, what she's doing, and it's kind of more interesting than the entire first act of the film. Like we could have started with her on the boat and spent some more time on the island, and I think that would... Like, not to say that there aren't some really great scenes in the opening. The bike chase scene is really good and...
It is, it's really
a lot
good.
Of fun. But narratively, it's just kind of extra fluff.
It is, it's just surplus. Because, like, we don't need a Lara Croft origin movie that starts right from the beginning, because we've had two Lara Croft films, so we know like what she becomes.
Yeah.
We just want to know where she is now.
Yeah,
they could have just started it with her like picking up the inheritance or whatever, or not picking it up or whatever it is she does, and getting the video recording.
Yeah, we don't like, and again, Indiana Jones held off on that until the third film. Like they, like those first two films, understood that we knew the premise of the character from the off, from something that they showed
we
us.
We get it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, so we've had two Lara Croft films and then umpteen Indiana Jones films. We know this character.
Yeah, exactly. nobody is turning up to Tomb Raider not knowing vaguely what it's about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if they are, it's pretty like clear pretty early on without having an origin story. It's not like there's some complex kind of sci-fi powers or something.
No.
She's just a woman who goes around the world like nicking stuff from other cultures.
Yeah. That's, yeah, wasn't that the box quote on the first Tomb Raider game?
But the real reason that I'm annoyed with the beginning bit is that the fact that they cut down the boat scene, which is because I think he was a great character.
Yeah.
Lu Ren was like a cool character, and they had a real sort of chemistry that I really enjoyed, and I wanted more boat time. But he's basically just a taxi driver who then does nothing for the rest of the film.
Yeah, he's another Calvin, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
Like, yeah. To the point where, like, kind of at the end, where they're like at the climax, where she's like deep in the heart of this horrible tomb, he's escaping with the rest of the enslaved people, and he decides to turn back and help. And then that's it. He doesn't actually help. He just...
do anything.
No, he kind of stands outside the tomb and waits for her to come out.
Yeah. And then, like, moves a rock or gives her his hand and pulls her out, and that's it. Yeah, he's completely wasted because he's really charismatic
actor.
He is. And, yeah, that's, like, a great start. He's the drunken boat captain. He's kind of, you know, sort of Han Solo to her Luke.
Yeah.
And it could have been great.
Yeah.
It could have been a beautiful friendship, but no.
And after they sort of took the setting and they took the basic plot from the game, that was the thing that I was most disappointed that they didn't carry over, was that she has a team in that game. There's an ensemble cast of characters who are... that in the game, they are kind of stock characters. They could have been done better, but like it's just not bothered with at all in this one. It's just her and him, who's not really in the film, and the bad guys.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's a shame. But having said that, I do think it's probably the best game to film.
Yeah, like, it is, and that's really disappointing because I still don't think it's very good. There is still not a good film of a video game.
I've
said that a bunch of times, that is my sworn position, is that there are no good video game films.
I don't know anyone who would really fight you on that one.
This is one of the best ones, and I think primarily it's because of this Alicia new character, Vikander. Yeah, Alicia Vikander, and this new characterization of Lara. She is really good, and she's very watchable, and you know, I would watch a series of films with her as this character, which I don't know if they're going to make now.
No, because she is I mean, they couldn't have cast her better. They could have got someone who could speak with an English accent.
It does slip quite a lot.
One day we'll get an English Lara Croft. But she looks perfect, and obviously we know that she's a brilliant actress, so she was absolutely spot on for that kind of, you know, quite girlish, she's, you know, that young sort of looking, and she's convincing as the strong Lara. She obviously, you know, did a lot of training for that role. They avoid the over-sexualization which Angelina Jolie's films reveled in. The infamous shower scene.
Watch that film again.
Someone say shower scene.
It pretty much entirely avoids direct sexualization. There was one shot which you noticed, but I didn't, where it was it filmed down her top a little bit.
It was just a really weird shot of she'd been stabbed in the side. She was looking at it, but it looked like chin cam view. So it basically looked down her chest to her side. It was like, okay, odd angle. And also the opening scene where she's oiled and fighting in the boxing ring.
Okay, yeah, there is that as well, yeah.
I mean, it was kind of, the excuse was, we're showing how strong and capable she is, but there was a lot of lingering sort of oiled, taut limbs and things. But overall, it did avoid the sort of classic Lara is a sexy chick with guns thing.
So it really did a good job with reimagining the character for film from the Angelina Jolie version. It is a shame that the rest of the film is still kind of not much better than the plots of, you know, those two movies.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Yeah. But there we go.
Yeah. So that's Tomb Raider.
It is. Yeah. Tell us what you thought of Tomb Raider and everything, and all the other films.
Any films. Any films you like. Just
yes, or films you want us to argue the toss about, in fact. That would be good, too.
Yep.
Anything we've missed that we needs arguing about. Mm-hmm. Chat to us on... We're on Twitter at ArgueTheCast, Libsyn, SoundCloud, iTunes,
and you can of course find us on GameIndustry.com.
And there we are. Come chat to us.
Yeah,
we like it.
We do.
So, until next time, Drew.
Cheerio.